Good afternoon and welcome on in to Kildare Focus. You're listening to KFM. My name is Caoimhe Hearney. I'll be with you until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Coming up on today's show, we'll be speaking to Michael Glesby. He's General Secretary of the Teachers Union of Ireland. They have a recruitment and retention crisis in the sector and they're calling on the government to introduce incentives to bring teachers back into the country. We'll be speaking to Linda Kavanagh. She's Communications Manager with the Sex Workers Alliance of Ireland. National efforts carried out by Gardaí to protect sex workers in many cases are having the opposite effect. We'll be speaking to Stephen O'Hare. He's the Executive Director of HIV Ireland. Today is World HIV Day. How do we stop the stigma even though we've had many, many advances in the medication and the cure to HIV is coming? And then Dan Donoher is from is the manager of Kildare Wildlife Centre. He has been nominated for as Volunteer Manager of the Year Award and he will be speaking to us about the Christmas appeal to help with the costs of running the centre. And of course, if you want to get in touch with the show, you can text us 0833 97 97 97. You can call us 045 898 999 or you can email us studio@kfmradio.com.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Hearney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, teacher unions have called for a range of incentives to encourage teachers to return to work in Ireland, including housing measures in key pressure zones. Such is the crisis in the sector. Joining me now on the line is Michael Glesby, General Secretary of the Teacher Union of Ireland. Good afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon.
Just how bad is this crisis, Michael?
Well, I think your listeners are hearing it every day. We know that I deal with post-primary schools. We know that we have teachers who are, you know, on maternity leave or out sick because, you know, the days of going in with a heavy cold and surviving teaching can't happen now because of COVID. So every day we know that there are out-of-field teachers. Teachers are not qualified in the subject in front of classes in post-primary schools, or in some cases, no teacher because we can't get subs. At the moment, we're depending very much on our trainee teachers. We've released them from their training because, you know, and try to compact their training so that they can put a sticking plaster on it. We've also introduced sticking plaster things over the last number of years of allowing teachers who are job sharing to do more hours, teachers on career breaks, being able to work in other schools maybe that might suit them better. These are all things that have been announced year in, year out, but they're not making the crisis go away. The crisis is getting worse. Because we have teachers who are fully trained and abroad, so we need to bring them back. How can we bring them back? The only way we can bring them back is to give them permanent jobs when they return, instead of giving them fixed-term contracts where they can't get a mortgage, even though they might have the deposit because they've been abroad, they can't get a mortgage because they won't get a permanent job for 2 or 3 years. Teachers who are newly coming out will only get hours first. They don't get a full-time job. How can you live on a part-time job? So what they're doing is the countries that know we've got very good teachers, they're recruiting them at different times of the year. Any time of the year, they're giving them a job and they're giving them a permanent job. Just come to our country. And they're doing it. So they're taking them away from our schools because our schools don't have the flexibility of offering jobs only in September. So by the time they're ready to recruit at the end of an academic year, most of the newly qualified teachers are abroad. So we have to try and bring them back. And we're not creating a system that can bring them back. We've got a lot of problems. Then we have now reaching a stage where we've more resignations than we have retirements. So people are leaving the teaching profession as well. So we need to be able to retain them because we got rid of a promotional structure in 2009 and we've never returned it. And on top of that, then, we haven't made teaching attractive. Work intensification, over-expanding workload, bureaucracy, large classes. It's going to make a teaching as an attractive profession fall further. And it's going to be a sad picture if, in the near future, young people don't want to be teachers because they see this. So we've got to do something now. And we put in 5 or 6 things that the minister should do now. Some of them are cost neutral because we already have the teachers teaching in the schools. Just make them permanent. Give them permanent jobs.
Michael, that's great what you've said there. If you just don't mind moving a slight bit because you're breaking up here and there.
Sorry, okay.
But we can hear you, but it's just slightly, the line is a little bit bad.
Okay,
if you want,
is that okay? Yeah.
That sounds good now, Michael, yeah. If you want to outline then what the teacher unions are calling for, you said there's about 5 or 6 things.
Well, obviously, as I said, permanently, if we're bringing someone home, they're not going to come home to a part-time job or a temporary job. So they need to get permanent jobs. That's the first thing. They also, if they've been in different jurisdictions, they've got experience, they've learned a lot, so let's give them incremental credit, because teachers move up an incremental scale over 20 years. So let's move them in where they belong. And again, that'll attract them to bring them home, because they're not on low starting pay. And they'll be able to, as I said, be able to, they may have the deposit of a house, but they'll be able to get a meaningful mortgage and buy a house then. So that's the first thing. We need to bring back postal responsibility, because postal responsibility are what our schools depend on in terms of pastoral, curricular, and administrative care. And because teachers don't have anywhere to be promoted to, except to be a principal, and not every teacher wants to be a principal, because you can't get teachers, it's so difficult, we need to create that post structure as well. And that will support our schools and support even the announcement today of bullying. If we have, year heads in school, etc., which were all cut in 2009 and never restored. We also have to reimagine the way we recruit teachers. Recruiting teachers at the end of the year for next year, and even though we have needs, unmet needs during the year, the fact we can't recruit in the middle of the year is creating problems. Our other jurisdictions have no problem coming into hotels in Ireland or, being on other radio stations telling them we'll teach you how to scuba dive in Australia if you come to our jurisdictions. So our schools are not able to compete with these countries and agencies coming in recruiting our teachers. Why are they recruiting them? They're recruiting because they know they're the very best possibly in the world as teachers. The other problem we have at the moment is teaching is too expensive to become a teacher. It takes 6 years. 4 years to do your degree and then 2 years to do your what used to be the higher diploma in education, now it's a PME. So 6 years before you're qualified, it's too long. And people are voting before they ever go into teaching now. They're not doing the final qualifications for teaching. So we've made it too hard to become a teacher. And then you come out and you have to wait for a permanent job. So those people are going abroad because they have permanent jobs day one.
I remember when I was down in University of Limerick, at that time you could do like science education, 4-year course, and then you were a teacher. But I think, like you said, that was done away with then a short time later, Michael. So I suppose bringing something like that back in where it's just a 4-year degree.
Well, there are still concurrent degrees around, but an awful lot of people want to do a degree in their subject and then the PME because it gives them more options. So. But by adding another year to the PME has just made it, it's changed it from 5 years even to 6 years. And, people are older leaving school now because of the transition year or whatever. So sometimes before they even get their first job, they're 25 years of age. And, there's been a delay then. And then they have a delay in starting all the other things that we take for granted, like buying a house or starting a family is all delayed because they're another couple of years then waiting for the permanent job. So we've managed to create a perfect storm in teaching where we are now reaping the rewards where there's now a scarcity of teacher. And no, unless we take drastic action soon, it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse.
Mm. I have a few messages coming in here. The general feeling is, Michael, that teachers generally, have a good job. They don't work as many days as other people. Like I know today there, because of the new bank holiday that's been brought in, St. Bridget's Day, secondary schools will only be open 166 days of the year. Primary level, it's 182. Many teachers off for the majority of the summer. Is it that people just want to move away and experience life and not live in Ireland? Like, luring teachers back in, like most teachers don't work the same amount as any other profession.
Well, as I said, for the first time ever, the amount of resignations exceeds the amount of retirements in teaching. So that says it all. The job has become too tough. Work intensification, workload, bureaucracy. I mean, if it is as attractive and as easy job as people seem to think, why are we struggling to recruit teachers? Why we have one of the biggest teaching registers in the world, 120,000 people on it, right? So more than enough teachers to fulfill our needs, but they're not teaching. They're transferring into other professions and other jobs because a lot of them do have transferable skills and they're moving. Now, it's happening across the world. It's not just Ireland, but Ireland has experienced it a bit later. But we have a crisis. And as I said, you only have to talk to any parent who knows that there's not a teacher in front of their students. So if it is so attractive, I can't understand then why people are not beating down the doors to become teachers. But they're not. In fact, it's the reverse. They're leaving teaching.
Okay. You speak about bureaucracy. In what way, Michael?
Well, bureaucracy, what's happened is, I mean, most teachers enter the teaching profession and the bit they love about it is teaching, dealing with the students. But over the last 20 years, there's been increased number of filling in forms, order forms for this, order forms for that, bureaucracy, tick box exercises, the way teachers will describe it. So a whole range of bureaucracy that has to be, goes through, and it's added to the workload. But no time has been created in the school day. So what you have is you've got teachers doing what they're primarily employed to do, which is teaching and looking after students and caring for their students, which is the bit they love. And then hours upon hours on top of that, then filling in forms or bureaucratic detail, all possibly now obviously computerized, but nevertheless still bureaucratic, that they have to do just to keep records, you know.
I think we would hear similar things from doctors and nurses there as well, Michael. Would you be
filling in the same form five or six times for five or six different organizations, all state organizations?
Would you be in favour of a bonus, you know, for the likes of rent pressure zones like up in Dublin? Obviously here in Kildare, we're a rent pressure zone. Would you be in favour of something like that?
Well, look, I mean, we can only go by in England. It didn't work. It didn't work in London. And they were able to create zones based on, you know, the travel systems they had in public transport. We don't know whether that would work. I mean, it depends on when you bought your house. It depends on, you know, someone bought it in 2013 when the market was low. Are they as disadvantaged? And we also have teachers who couldn't afford to buy in these rent pressure zones who bought houses now, we'll say, 100 kilometres away from when they work. And they thought they were doing the right thing. And now they're suffering because they can't afford to put fuel in their car because the price of diesel has doubled. So there's no simple fix like that. But the first thing you can do is give everybody permanent jobs day one. What tends to happen in London as well is when they gave the London allowance, all that happened was everybody put up their prices in London and London just became a dearer city.
In fairness, Michael, I suppose, you know, obviously you have a crisis in the sector, but like, is it realistic to say we're going to give everyone a permanent job straight away? Like most professions, when you come out of college, they won't give you a permanent job straight away.
Well, no, I think most people do get permanent jobs straight away. Teaching is the one that you have to wait 2 years. Like in 2016, you have to wait 4 years. Now, the unions managed to negotiate that down to 2 years. But certainly when I came out of college and I'm a teacher, I walked straight into a permanent job day one.
Okay.
You know, so people do walk into teaching permanent, and every other jurisdiction is giving teachers permanent jobs day one. That's why our teachers are walking with their feet to these jurisdictions. And you're right, they are going because it's exciting and to experience life in these places, but they are also going because there's other guarantees. Certain jurisdictions give free accommodation. Some things we obviously can't compete with the weather in Australia or whatever. So people are always going to go for a year or two. What I'm talking about is, how are we going to get them back? They're not going to come back. These are experienced teachers who may have been teaching for 5 or 6 years. How are we going to get them back if we don't give them permanent jobs and jobs that they can buy a house with? We're not talking about someone starting off as an NQT. The ones we want to bring home are experienced teachers.
Okay. Well, that is Michael Gillespie, General Secretary of the Teachers Union of Ireland. Teacher unions calling for a range of incentives to encourage teachers to return to work in Ireland because there is a major crisis in the sector. Michael, thank you very much for joining us.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Last week, Gardaí targeted 11 counties and carried out 5 search warrants as part of a national effort to protect sex workers. However, Linda Kavanagh from the Sex Workers Alliance of Ireland has said last week's operation has had a negative impact on some workers. Joining me now on the line is Linda Kavanagh. Good afternoon, Linda.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Linda, tell us a little bit about what your alliance does and what the work that you do.
Sure. The Sex Workers Alliance of Ireland exists to ensure that sex workers have a voice in Ireland. Currently, sex workers are invisible and they don't have any power or say in the policies that affect their lives. So we're working to change that. We're a frontline organisation that is made up of sex workers and allies.
And around how many workers would you work with?
So we'd be in contact with about 100 sex workers every year. We've given out hardship funds and mm-hmm. vouchers to help sex workers through, obviously, what's been a very trying couple of years, as it has been for everyone.
I suppose it's something, when we speak about sex, of course, sometimes in Ireland it can be a taboo. But for people who don't know, selling sexual services in Ireland is legal. However, it is against the law to buy or offer to buy sexual services and to sell or offer sexual services on behalf of any person other than yourself on a street or a public place. Is that correct, Linda?
Yes, that is correct. It's also, the law kind of goes further than that. It also means that sex workers can't share premises if there are more than one sex worker in a premises. That's considered brothel keeping. So okay. Most jobs, you know, including the Gardaí, don't perform their duties on their own. But sex workers are forced to work alone, to work, say, legally. And that obviously means that they feel and can be less safe. Predators can target sex workers because it's a cash business and they're working on their own. They're mostly women. So they can become victims to predators, robbers and assaulters. So one of the ways that sex workers, and this is like almost all sex workers that we talk to, would like to be safe is to work alongside someone. But because the law is so broadly written, it means that they can't share premises. And this has had real world consequences. This isn't just a theoretical thing. Sex workers are arrested constantly for sharing premises under the brothel keeping law, and some have actually been jailed.
Linda, Superintendent Derek Maguire said human trafficking is an issue facing every county in Ireland. Would you agree with that statement?
I don't know if I would. I mean, human trafficking is absolutely an issue in this country, and it's an issue in all industries. There's a huge issue with labour trafficking in Ireland, but it really gets focused on sex trafficking. But because of the way that sex trafficking and sex work is viewed in Ireland, it's just so broad that it's considered in the law and by the state as all sex work is gender-based violence. And what that really does is flatten the discourse completely. Like, what language do sex workers use if they've been raped and assaulted, if according to the government and according to, you know, the discourse, it's all gender-based violence, it's all assault. So it's really hard to know around the statistics around trafficking in Ireland. I suppose I should really say as well that no one wants to get rid of exploitation in sex work more than sex workers themselves. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, sex work is driven underground by the laws, even though, as we said, sex work is supposed to be legal, it's supposed to be decriminalised in Ireland. But because aspects of it, like sharing premises, like the purchase of sex, are criminalised, it creates a criminalised environment. And then the onus of the law really falls on the sex worker to keep their clients safe because they need to keep their income safe. I think that's something that's really not recognised in Ireland, is sex work is an economic activity. Majority of sex workers are doing it because they need or want money. And until that income is replaced by something else, this will continue to happen. And when it's driven underground by laws, exploitation is rife there. So it's really difficult to know the statistics around trafficking in Ireland. But as there have been like many raids on premises over the last couple of weeks, both in Northern Ireland and here, we're not really hearing about the welfare of any of those workers. And that's really scary. Like, these are real people whose workplace has been raided and we don't know anything about them. They could just scatter and they're not getting any services and they're not getting any help if they are being exploited. We're just not hearing about it.
Yeah. Gardaí spoke with 112 sex workers during welfare checks last week, Linda. Some reported positive engagement, but you're saying that some have found it to be a negative experience.
Yeah, absolutely. They felt, look, we've been inundated with texts and messages and calls from sex workers about this because they're really scared. What the Gardaí do is they scrape the numbers of the sex workers from the websites they advertise, and then they text them out of the blue And it makes sex workers feel very surveyed. And then they're calling to the premises where they know sex work happens. And by the way, they're pretending to be clients. They're booking in as clients. So to gain access to sex workers, they're lying. And when they get there, they're asking them about their landlords. And so the sex workers now are feeling really terrorized, feeling really lied to, and now also have the threat of eviction hanging over them. So there's a massive problem with trust with the Gardaí in the sex work community. Less than 1% of sex workers will report an assault or crime against them to the Gardaí. And if you compare that to the general population, 90% of people have trust in the Gardaí. That's a massive difference. And the way to gain trust between the Gardaí and sex workers is not to lie to them and book in as clients. This is absolutely not the way to go about it. So yes, there may have been really positive outcomes from the Gardaí, according to their press release. But we are also hearing very negative things. People are scared that it's a scam. Then they're scared asking why Gardaí have their number. And then what are they calling to their house? Are they really Gardaí calling to their house? Because this is an issue as well of predators pretending to be Gardaí. So I really question these methods in terms of trying to improve trust with the Gardaí.
When the guards arrive to the house, Linda, you know, do they say where they've gotten the numbers and do they say why they're asking about their landlords?
I believe what they've said about the landlords is that what's happening is illegal, so they need to contact the landlords, or the fact that sex is being sold out of the premises.
Okay.
So that's obviously very, very scary. But this happened last year as well, where welfare checks did result in sex workers getting evicted over winter. So this is really, really, this is not an unfounded fear by sex workers, because this has happened. And this happens kind of regularly every year. It's really a very strange thing to me that this is part of the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. But the net result is to terrorise what are mostly women doing an economic activity.
Is there anything that we as the public can do?
I mean, I think some very basic things like talk to the person. That we can tend to look at these things through our own lenses and our own lives. But sex workers tend to be, it's a community made up of mostly marginalised people, migrants, undocumented people, trans people, people in addiction, homeless people. They're already kind of on the margins of society. So we may be looking at their lives through our own lens. It is an issue in Ireland that the only way that people can get trafficking status is to go to the Gardaí, and they must participate in kind of criminal proceedings, which a lot of people are just unwilling to do. Maybe their family is being threatened back home by traffickers and stuff. So it's a complex issue. Human trafficking is really complex. The best way to combat it is to prevent it. So we don't have silver bullet solutions. The way that we can prevent trafficking is making people resilient to trafficking, which is ensuring that they have adequate housing, have domestic violence support, addiction supports if they need them, affordable childcare. The housing crisis is a massive issue. Well-paid jobs. All of these things ensure people are resilient to trafficking. And that's something that we call for in the Sex Workers Alliance. Because, nobody wants to see the end of trafficking more than sex workers. And one major way that we could help trafficking is to decriminalise sex work, so that sex workers aren't forced to interact with the Gardaí, but they feel empowered to interact with the Gardaí when they see exploitation within their own ranks. But sex workers are a frontline asset to Gardaí if they were allowed to be. But because the law positions them kind of on opposing sides, this information is being lost. So we call for the decriminalisation of sex work as one of many steps to end trafficking in Ireland.
Okay, brilliant. That is Linda Kavanagh, Communications Manager with the Sex Workers Alliance of Ireland. Linda, thank you very much for joining us.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney.
Now, today marks World AIDS Day, the 35th time that this date has been marked globally. It remembers those we have lost to AIDS and raises awareness of HIV-related stigma since the onset of the devastating and persistent pandemic more than four decades ago. Joining me now on the line is Stephen O'Hare, Executive Director of HIV Ireland. Good afternoon, Stephen.
Good afternoon.
Stephen, how are things now for people who are currently living with HIV in Ireland? Has much changed?
Yeah, in the past four decades, a lot has changed. People living with HIV can now access effective treatments. And those treatments, when taken regularly, mean that somebody can suppress the virus in their system to such a degree that it actually becomes undetectable. And what that means is, it means two things. One, it means that HIV is no longer a health threat to that person, so they can live a long and healthy life. And the other thing it means, and the really crucial thing it means, is that they cannot actually pass on HIV to anybody else. They cannot pass HIV on through sexual contact, for example. So that's very important in terms of how we think about people living with HIV and what it means to live with HIV. What we want to do is to ensure that everybody living with HIV is on effective treatment. That's the goal.
Okay, and what is the treatment then? It's a pill that people can take, is it?
Yeah, different medications in different circumstances. But generally, it's a one pill a day or a small number of pills a day that people take. And they basically just do that daily. They're taken orally. And that pill, that medication will ensure, it's antiretroviral therapy is what it's called. And that medication will ensure that the virus is unable to replicate. So it becomes a very, 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 very small number of copies of that virus in the person's system. And so effectively, the person is almost living without HIV, although that's not quite the case. Effectively, you know, HIV is not detectable in their system.
Okay. And there's obviously other advances here that I see you have written about. Soon people might be able to just not have to take the pills and we'll be able to get infusions or injections. And
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the good news is that the drug companies are working hard to take the burden even on from daily medication off people. And what people will be able to do soon, it's recently just been licensed by the European Medicines Agency, is long-acting injectable treatments. So people will go and get an injection, and then they won't have to think about their HIV treatment or medication for 2 months. And then they might return again for another injection. So you might only have to visit your clinic maybe six times a year. And as technology advances, of course, that window will get longer and maybe it might be a twice yearly injection, you know, down the line. So it really does take the burden off people living with HIV in terms of medication.
Okay, and the medication that people are taking now, does that stop the spread, say, if you're HIV positive and your partner isn't, does that stop the spread of the virus?
Absolutely. So if you're a person who's HIV positive and you have to take medication and you reach an undetectable viral load, which is what will happen if you take the medication, you cannot pass on HIV to a HIV negative person. So that is critical. But the medication also, there's also a medication called PrEP. And if you're a person who's not living with HIV, so if you're HIV negative, you can take a sort of a version of antiretroviral therapy called PrEP. And PrEP is taken before sex. And it means that you cannot acquire HIV from somebody who's HIV positive and not on effective treatment. So essentially, it's almost like a double protection. A person living with HIV takes medication, they can't pass it on. And a person who isn't living with HIV can take medication to ensure that they don't acquire HIV through sex. So it really is a revolution in terms of what's available.
Okay, Stephen, if the science underpinning the drive to eliminate HIV is winning, then why is there so much stigma surrounding HIV? Why is it so persistent?
Well, that's the really important question. There is a persistence of stigma surrounding HIV, and a lot of it goes back to fear, misinformation, a lack of awareness, a lack of education around HIV, and a lot of myths around HIV that still persist. And unfortunately, back in the time when HIV was a crisis and the AIDS crisis was looming around the 80s and 90s, a lot of myths persisted around HIV that it could be transmitted simply by sharing cutlery or sharing a cup or hugging or kissing or spitting or any of those things. And the reality, and the reality always was, that HIV cannot be transmitted in those ways. The only way that HIV can be transmitted is through sexual contact or blood transfusion. So really, that has a lot of fear and misconceptions have grown up around that. And so people living with HIV face that stigma. And there's also a sort of a moral judgment that goes along with HIV. So people tend to sort of morally judge why a person is living with HIV. You know, is it because you're a promiscuous? Is it because you're gay? Is it because you've used drugs in the past and maybe shared a needle? And those things, again, persist as kind of stigmatizing attitudes. But we know that HIV now is a chronic treatable condition. It's no longer the life-threatening condition it was if you have access to medication, which we do in Ireland. And anybody who has HIV has access to that medication. And so, you know, we know that those things have changed. And so people shouldn't face that stigma. And really, we need to look at how we are treating people and our attitudes towards people living with HIV.
Okay, Stephen O'Hare, Executive Director of HIV Ireland. Today marks World AIDS Day, the 35th time that this date has been marked globally. Stephen O'Hare, thank you very much for joining us. Now, joining me on the line is Dan Donaher. He is the volunteer manager at Kildare Wildlife Centre, which is located in Kildare Town. Dan has been nominated for a Volunteer Manager of the Year award by his colleagues. Good afternoon, Dan.
Good morning, or good evening, sorry.
Are you only out of bed, Dan?
No, it's been a long day already.
Yeah. I know. Dan, first of all, fair play on getting nominated. It says here that Dan is gracious with his time and his knowledge. So there you go, Dan. You're gracious for KFM too, coming on to talk to us. Tell us a little bit about the work that you do over in the Kildare Wildlife Centre.
Yeah, so we set up our Wildlife Rehabilitation Centre here in Kildare Town just 4 months ago, actually. So we rehabilitate native wildlife, so they find them maybe injured on the road or come in to us for rehabilitation. So we get them better and then we bring them back to where we found them and release them back into the wild.
Okay, and how has it been going? How's it been going so far, Dan? Have you many volunteers over there?
Yeah, so we've about, altogether in the whole organisation, we've 100 volunteers and they do different, so there's volunteers at the centre, there's education volunteers, admin volunteers, rescue volunteers as well, so they make up, there's about 50 of those and they're around mainly Kildare, Dublin and Leash.
Okay. If someone wants to get involved, maybe lives in the area or anywhere in Kildare, of course, how do they do so or how do they go about it?
Yeah, so they can give us an email at volunteer@kwr.ie or they can give us a message on our social media outlets as well. And we have a volunteer coordinator who will give them a ring, have a chat about what's involved and see where they might fit within the organisation because we'll take anybody, you know, people think that they need to be have an education on animal care or something like that, but that's not true. We can fully train people in and they might fit maybe an admin role or something like that. So there's something there for everybody.
Okay. What's the main animal that you have over there or what's the one that you rescue the most?
Mainly at this time of year, we'll see a lot of hedgehogs. So they would be maybe too small to hibernate and they would come into us. We see a lot of swans, especially at this time of year. What else? A lot of foxes, actually.
Okay.
So a lot of them getting involved in road traffic accidents. So like 90% of the animals that come into our care are because of humans, so of human interaction. And that's why we kind of, the work we do is important because we're kind of trying to balance out that. We are in the middle of a biodiversity crisis, so we're just trying to balance out and get as many animals back into the wild so that we can keep our biodiversity going, you know.
Yeah. Dan, I'm looking here at your Christmas appeal and I have to say the headlines are very, very catchy. Tell me a little bit about obviously you're a charity and you run on donations, so you're always looking for any help that you can get. A feast for a fox is one of the Christmas appeals. Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, so we've just launched our Christmas appeal on iDonate and they've kindly helped us out with that. So we've a feast for a fox and that will help feed a fox for a week and that's €10. And then we have our or otter ones. So they're kind of an animal that many people wouldn't see. You might see a splash in a river or a canal but and not know what it is. But they're very mysterious. But we actually have four of them in our care at the moment. And they're very costly because they need fresh fish. So we can people can sponsor one of them for €20. And then we have a €30 bundle where to kind of help feed and look after 12 species of birds. So if people want to sign up for that, you get a lovely care of a certificate of care, and you can give that as a present or just have it for yourself as well. So it's a nice gift to give this Christmas.
Yeah, it's definitely a great one for any animal lovers out there. And of course, then you're helping other people out. And then, of course, cutting down on some waste coming up to the Christmas, because I know we're all trying to do that at the moment. Dan, again, give us how people can donate there and also if they want to become a volunteer, lastly.
Yeah, so they can contact us by info@kwr.ie and they'll get all our information from there. Or they can check us out on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, Kildare Wildlife Rescue.
Okay, Dan Donaher, Volunteer Manager at Kildare Wildlife Centre. He has also been nominated for Volunteer Manager of the Year. That's an award. The announcement will be made tomorrow, Dan. So best of luck with that. And of course, we hope you win.
Thanks so much.